So I'm going to tell you today about Z-prime bosons and possible connection to light hidden sectors at the LHC. This is work done with Seth Quackenbush, grad student at Madison, Catherine Zurich, currently a postdoc at Madison, and Yuri Gerstein, an experimentalist at FSU. Okay, so what I want to do is I want to ask the following question. Given a discovery of a Z-prime at the LHC, which is something which is a distinct possibility given its ubiquitous appearance in many models of new physics, what can we learn from this discovery? There's basically two questions that I want to ask. The first is, how well can we determine its couplings in order to determine what the underlying theory from which it arose is? And what I'm going to do to try to answer this question is a few things. First, I want to do what I think at least is a fairly serious study of what are the biggest experimental errors and more particularly theoretical errors on this signal. So I'll do a study of analog QCD, PDF scale statistical errors, and try to quantify what exactly is the limiting factor in determining what the couplings are. I'll also introduce what I think is a nice parameterization for connecting what you observe from measuring the Z prime to the underlying theory, and I'll introduce a simple and complete analysis procedure to take into account all the possible kinematic information you can get from LHC measurements. Then I want to ask another question. Is the Z prime a messenger to some kind of light hidden sector? There are several places this appear in the theory literature. One is in some models of supersymmetry breaking. The other you heard from Matt a couple days ago. It appears in models of hidden valleys. So I want to ask the question, can we see if the Z prime is decaying invisibly, and in particular, is it decaying to something besides just neutrinos? And I'll try to answer that using a simulation at LHC of associated production of Z prime with either a Z or a photon, and we'll see that this is possible, well, with some assumptions. Okay, so let me first start with just a little bit of a general overview, just to tell you what a Z-prime is. You all know, but experimentally, a Z-prime is a residence observed in a dileptron channel. It's a very clean experimental signature. There's very low background for high-mass Z-primes. And one of the first questions to ask is, well, is it a Z-prime, which indicates it's coming from some gauge theory, or is it something else? Is it a spin-zero state? Is it a spin-two state that would indicate some type of theory of extra dimensions? And you can answer this question with LHC data. Basically, Z primes have a decay distribution of cosine squared theta, whereas graviton KK residences would go up to cosine to the fourth theta. And with about a few hundred events, you can distinguish whether you have a spin one state, a spin zero state, or a spin two state. And this has been studied somewhat extensively in the literature. So for the time being, we're going to assume that we found a Z prime. It's a spin one. We've determined that. Let's see what we can learn about it. Okay. Where do Z primes appear? Let me just give you a few examples. They're all over the place. It's hard to write a theory down without introducing some type of new Z prime. They appear as recurrences of the standard model Z in theories of extra dimensions. They appear in little Higgs theories in order to cancel quadratic divergences from gauge bosons. They appear in string models. Something which we'll be interested in here is the fact that they also are a convenient state to act as a messenger between the visible sector, whether that visible sector is MSSM or just SM, and between some hidden sector. This also appears in hidden valley models. So given all these things, people have studied, you know, quite extensively how well you can see these things at the LHC, and this is summarized in the following plot by Tom Rizzo. You ask yourself, given a certain amount of integrated luminosity at the LHC, how far is your Z prime reach? The answer is, well, with full luminosity at the LHC, about 100 inverse femtobarns. I go to this plot, I take the intersection of 100 inverse femtobarns with all these curves. These are basically curves for various different Z prime models, sequential standard model, et cetera, et cetera. So you ask yourself, well, with 100 inverse femtobarns, I can do, let's say, about 5 TeV or so. If I ask myself how well I can do with initial LHC data, let's say 100 inverse picobarns, go out to about 1 to 1.5 TeV. So that's the discovery reach for Z prime at the LHC. It can go rather high in mass. And just for some type of comparison, the current limits coming from Tevatron for the sequential standard model where the Z prime has the same couplings as the Z, there's about 1 TeV right now. Okay. So once we find the Z prime, what can we measure about it? Well, the obvious first things are you see a peak, you measure the position of the peak in mass, you measure the width of the peak. So there's been some simulation about how well you can determine these parameters. CMS and Atlas seem to say that you can determine the mass with a resolution at about a few percent level. It's a little bit tougher, at least for me, to find what the precision you can get on the width is. But basically, if the width over mass ratio is greater than about, let's say, 0.5 to 1%, it seems you'll see a bright Wigner as opposed to some Gaussian indicating just detector resolution. Okay, so this is the simple stuff. You measure the mass, you measure the width. Then you want to say, okay, where is the Z prime coming from? The key tool to this, which we're going to use in this talk, is the fact that Z prime decays to fermions indicate the underlying model. I measure the vector and the axial couplings, and I determine, for example, what's gauged. Is a Z prime gauging B minus L? Is it gauging something else? So we're going to use these as the window to the underlying model. There are other things which I won't talk about much here. There's possible through ZZ prime mixing, either kinetic or mass mixing, they can have various decay modes such as into Z Higgs, WW. These are important, for example, in little Higgs theories. There are other possible rare decays, and later we'll get to associated production of Z primes and use this later. But primarily, for the time being, we're going to focus on these fermionic decays. So we want to determine what the vector and axial couplings are. We want to see what the underlying model is. What are the tools that we have at our disposal from LHC data in order to do this? Basically, there are two primary tools. One is the forward-backward asymmetry of the Z prime. So if I ask myself, what does the production cross-section for a Z prime decaying to leptons look like? Well, it has a 1 plus cosine squared theta piece. And then if I start taking the couplings of the Z prime to right and left-handed fermions to be different, I get a linear term in cosine theta. So I get some type of parity violation. And measurement of this is quite sensitive to various Z prime models. This is shown up here in the following plot. What this plot is as a function of invariant mass. So you've taken lepton pairs, you've binned them in invariant mass. What's the forward-backwards asymmetry? These lines here, the purple, the red, the green, and I think that's another purple one there, these are for various models coming from basically E6 Z prime models and also left-right models. But the major thing to note is that there is some significant difference between A4 backwards as predicted by the various models. And this here is LHC data simulated with statistical errors only. You see that there's quite a bit of discriminatory power between the various models by measuring A4 backwards. So that's one tool you have. The other tool you have is from the rapidity distribution of the Z prime. As we heard from Nima the other day, once you go above x equals 0.1 or so from parton distribution functions, you start seeing the remnants of the quark model appearing. And in particular, you see remnants of the fact there are more up quarks and down quarks in the proton. So the up quark distribution has more support at large x. Large x is correspondent to large rapidity. So what you see is if the Z prime couples to up quarks, shown here in green, you have a broader distribution in rapidity. This is the rapidity of the Z prime boson normalized. So the up quark leads you to some broad rapidity distribution. Coupling to down quarks have something that's a little bit more peaked. So if you can probe this rapidity spectrum, you get some idea of what the coupling to up or down quarks are. One thing which we'll use a little bit later, you can just kind of eyeball this. You can stare at this green line, which is for up quarks. You can stare at this red line, which is for down quarks. And you can see that you can get quite a bit of discriminatory power just from chopping this rapidity distribution into two bins. I chop it here, right at this intersection point, and I get a lot of discriminatory power just from that. One other thing I should talk about just to be complete before going on is at a proton-proton collider, there's no idea of what the direction is. So how do you measure A4 backwards? Well, what you do is you flag events with the rapidity of the Z prime. The Z prime is moving in some direction. It's primarily the fact that this is the quark direction. So you flag that, you form an A4 backwards that way. Okay, so these are the tools that we have. And of course, there's been some study of these by the experimental collaborations. And I'm showing you some fairly recent typical studies that have been done. So this first one here by CMS, what they do is they look at various models. So here's a left-right model, sequential standard model, some E6 gut models. And they do things like compute the A4 backwards for the various models. They compare them. They put in some type of statistical errors here. These statistical errors are denoted by these little, I think that's blue, these blue bands. And for example, this is 1 TeV Z prime. This is 10 inverse femto barns. You do some type of comparison to, you take the data that you measure, you compare it to a model. You see whether it fits that model and how many sigma you can distinguish it from another model. This is another similar study for a 3 TeV Z prime with 400 inverse femto barns. You see you don't do nearly as well because the statistical error is much larger. You don't have as many events. There are similar things done with the rapidity distribution down here. But the major point I want to get across with this is, at least when I'm looking at the literature of what the experimentalists have done with this, I mean, it's very nice. They do a lot of good stuff with this, but it seems to be that they're comparing single observables. They're putting some template models in. And it would be nice to improve this in a couple ways. The first is, how can we combine all of this kinematic information in order to get the best possible discrimination between Z prime models? Do we have to use these specific models, or is there some nice framework for actually just measuring some general charges and seeing what theory you get out? Also, it's important to quantify what are the effects of the various errors. What are the most important errors that are preventing you from determining what the couplings of the Z prime are? So these are the kind of things that we want to try to answer. Okay. So let me go on. I think. Okay. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to show you a simulation basically a Z-prime production at the LHC. It'll be NLO QCD. We're going to try to be as realistic as possible, put in all acceptance corrections, put in all correlations, etc. We're going to try to assess the effects of what are the important errors, basically, that are preventing us from distinguishing Z-prime from different models, and try to quantify what are the important things we need to control. And I'll just quote you the result of that here. Basically, we'll find out that both statistical errors and PDF errors are comparable, and they act in an interesting fashion. They have a very, very funny correlation. We'll see how that works in a little bit. Turns out other errors, such as a residual higher-order QCD effects, detector systematics, all these are expected to be small. So the major things, we're going to have to accumulate statistics. We're going to have to understand Poisson distribution functions. I'll also introduce what I think is a nice analysis procedure to use all of this kinematic information in one fell swoop, to use this four-backwards asymmetry, to use rapidity distribution in order to distinguish Z-prime properties, which is much of the LHC information as possible. And I'll introduce what I think is a nice parameterization that's both complete and convenient for comparing the data to the theory. Okay, so let me first give you just a little bit of theoretical framework. These first few things here just telling you what kind of assumptions I'm putting on my Z-prime model. They could be lifted if you wish, but I'm going to assume Z-prime couplings are generation independent. You can imagine testing this by trying to observe either TT-bar or tau decays. That will have some mass reach, although it'll be a little bit limited. Members of doublets have the same couplings, which I think is fairly reasonable. And when you put these assumptions on, you find out that you have five parameters that you need to measure to determine what the Z-prime is. You have couplings to left-handed quark doublets, left-handed lepton doublets, and the right-handed states. I'll assume for the purpose of this study, no ZZ prime mixing. There'll be some heavy right-handed neutrinos and heavy other stuff to cancel all anomalies. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to introduce some model-independent parameterization, but at some point I need to go to a specific model just to, you know, compare to see how well the LHC can do. Given that model, what is the LHC going to find? How well the coupling is going to be? Determined what are the errors going to be, and I'll use just some standard ones from the literature. So eta, chi, psi model, which come from E6 breaking down for SO10, and also left-right symmetric model. I'll use these for illustration at some point. Okay, so let's go ahead and let's look a little bit at what the Z-prime production cross-section looks like. We're going to use on-peak data. We're actually studying extension to off-peak, but for the time being, you get most of the statistics just from on-peak. So if I look at the Z-prime cross-section on peak, what I can note is the following. I can notice that basically it comes purely from the Z-prime squared. If I look at Z-prime interfering with one of the standard model bosons, if I look at the standard model background, these things are percent-level contamination or less. So basically, on the peak, I have Z-prime squared contribution, and the cross-section takes the following form. I have there's first of all some over up and down quark contributions. There's a piece where I have just the right and left-handed coupling of the quark squared times the lepton coupling squareds. This is the piece that gives you the total cross section. Then I have another piece here which opens up if I have different right and left-handed couplings, right squared minus left squared for the quarks, right squared minus left squared for the leptons. And there are these other pieces here, A1Q, A2Q, where I lump in all the Poisson distribution functions, all the experimental cuts, all the PDFs, etc. So this is the form of the Z-prime differential cross-section on peak. And this is what you should look at to see, you know, what can you learn from the LHC, because it's all going to be set by what form this formula takes. And there's a few interesting things you can immediately note about what the LHC can do. One thing to note, first of all, is that there's some degeneracy between couplings. Note that if I take this and I take the quark couplings up by a factor of 2, I take the lepton couplings down by a factor of 2, my answer remains unchanged. So there's some degeneracy between quark and lepton couplings that I can't break just with LHC data, or at least with this Drell-Yan mode. And it turns out this is also true off-peak. I'll come back to that later. There are also various discrete ambiguities between whether I flip relative signs between charges that I can't break with this on-peak observables. Okay. So this is the form of the cross-section, and what I want to do is I want to have some way of separating the details of the model from the details of QCD, from the details of the experimental acceptances, et cetera, and we'll see why that's useful. We'll see why that makes it easy to simulate and measure Z-prime properties. So what we're going to do is we're going to take this, we're going to study it a little bit. So these factors A1Q, A2Q, they include all types of matrix elements, PDFs, et cetera. In particular, they also include the width from the Z-prime propagator. Now, the width from the Z-prime propagator is something that depends on the underlying model. If I change the charges around, I change the width over mass ratio around. And what I want to do is I want to remove that width from here, and I want to lump it into this piece which is a pure model-dependent piece, and then the piece which is just pure details of the experimental and simulation in QCD. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to redefine these couplings right here. I'm going to take a 1 over width factor, assuming narrow width approximation, absorb them into these couplings, and I'm going to define 4 couplings which completely determine the cross-section on peak for the Z-prime. So there are 2 so-called C couplings. These are the parity symmetric piece, right squared plus left squared for quarks and leptons. You can write that in terms of the branching fraction of Z-prime to leptons, if you will. These are 2 parity symmetric pieces. There's also 2 parity-violating pieces. These 4 couplings, the C's and the E's for both the up and down, they completely describe the on-peak production cross-section for the Z-prime. Now, when I write down the differential cross-section in terms of these couplings, what I find is the following. I find a sum over these charges, the C's and E's, times pieces which are completely independent of the underlying model. They depend on the Z-prime mass, and they depend upon no other details of the model. So this gives you a convenient way to separate the details of QCD and cuts just from what the underlying Z-prime model is. We'll see why that's useful in a slide or two. I should point out that this is an extension. Marcella Creighton and collaborators wrote a nice paper a few years back showing how you would use these C charges at the Tevatron to do some differentiation between Z-prime models. However, this was only useful for the total cross-section. This is basically an extension of this to deal with things like A4 backwards. Okay, so we have 4 quantities that we can measure from Z-prime production on peak, the C's and the E's. We want to use all the possible differential information to extract it, and what I'm going to propose is the following. Well, I have a 4 backwards asymmetry. I have rapidity distribution. I'm going to define 4 experimental regions. What I'm going to do, first of all, is define the usual 4 and backwards regions where I integrate the cross-section, let's say for cosine theta, from 0 to 1 or from minus 1 to 0. So this defines forward and backward that appear in the usual AFB. What I'm going to do is I'm going to further bend those in rapidity. I'm going to define a central rapidity where I integrate between some rapidity minus y1 and y1. This is in the central region of the detector. So I define a forward region, which I denote with a little less than sign. I define a kind of extreme rapidity region where I integrate from this cut y1 up until the maximum possible rapidity for the z-prime. So what I'm doing is I'm defining 4 regions acceptance for the z-prime. Basically, forward and central rapidity, forward and extreme rapidities, and the same for backwards. So I have 4 couplings I want to measure. I have 4 experimental regions that I can, experimentalists can go and measure the events in each of these 4 regions. I have some linear system of equations that I can invert to get the charges. See how that works. I have the measurements. The experimentalists go out and measure these 4 quantities when they discover a Z prime. I have these 4 charges. I have a matrix equation relating them, which depends upon the details of QCD, the experimental analysis, et cetera. And I can just invert this system to get what the charges are given the LHC measurements. So this is something I find to be kind of nice. I can study this matrix here. I can define all the effects of PDFs, all the effects of the acceptances, just by studying these quantities right here. And I can extract what the charges are without any underlying model assumption and just see what the charges are, see what kind of Z-prime model it is. So this is the analysis procedure that we're going to use. Let's see how well it works for LHC data. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to take this procedure. I'm going to take this this basically transfer matrix that takes me between the experimental couplings the coupling C and the experimental measurements M. I'm going to determine the effect of all possible errors on this, scale errors from QCD, statistical errors, partial distribution function errors, and see how well I can extract the couplings at the LHC. So here's a simulation of that, well, simulation in quotes of that, for these C couplings. Basically, this is a plot of C for the D quarks versus C for the U quarks, these parameters that determine the underlying Z prime model. This is for 100 inverse femtobarns of the LHC. And what I've done is I've used my example models that I told you before, a left-right model, various gut models such as chi, psi, and eta. And I've propagated through the errors for this on all the possible sources of error and to see how well I can get the charges out. And here's the result of that. So there's a few things I want to point out about this, which I think are kind of interesting. Let's look at this. Imagine the LHC measures a left-right model, or they find a Z prime. They measure a charge up here for the left-right model. What are the errors on this going to be? And the errors have a somewhat interesting form. So this dashed contour here, which I'm tracing, these are the statistical errors. This dotted contour that I'm tracing are the partial distribution function errors, and you can see that they actually act in orthogonal directions in this coupling space. This is fairly easy to understand. The statistical errors are small in the direction of CU plus CD. This is expected because CU plus CD is just the total rate. when I actually go to CU minus CD, I have to start doing something besides just adding Z prime, so my statistical error is going to increase. So that's why it's small in this, basically, this CU plus CD direction and large in this direction. The PDF errors, you note, have the exact opposite dependence. So they really give you quite a, well, it's kind of a bad thing because they give you a large volume in coupling space that it's occupied by the errors. But the PDFs, you can understand having a small error in this U minus D direction just because you have additional data sets in the Parkland distribution function fits that distinguish quite well between up and down quarks. These are current PDF uncertainties. I'll talk about that in a second. Okay, so this is approximately what you can do with LHC data. I'll quantify what these errors are a little more in a little bit, but you see this in. Yeah, these are basically using these 20 plus and minus eigenvectors in CTEC 6.5. Yeah. And I should point out there's also standard acceptance cuts, all of the usual stuff has been done. Okay, so there's this interesting interplay between PDF and statistical errors. So this is how well you can do on the measurements of the parity symmetric coupling CU and CD at the LHC. I'll quantify, basically give you a number for what these errors are in a little bit, but let's talk about some of the other stuff. How well can you do with the parity violating couplings? Well, these are a lot harder. With 100 inverse femtobarns, Barnes, not surprisingly, because you can see the statistical error piece right here is quite large. You need more statistics to get the parity violating pieces because you need to slice up phase space more. So you might ask yourself, okay, well, let's imagine I'm very optimistic. I'm going to go to super LHC. I'm going to get an inverse Attobarn of statistics. How well can one do? Now, the interesting thing that I found about this is that it really is becoming a precision measurement of Z prime properties at the LHC. You can see these error ellipses are quite small. Well, okay, there's no statistical error anymore. There are large PDF errors, but I'll get to that in a second. But you can do quite well. By the way, this contour that's appearing in the C couplings right here is an E6 model contour. If you have any E6 model, you look at what the contour is, and it traces out this form. So if you measure something not on there, well, you can immediately begin to see you have some type of E6 to SO10 breaking pattern. You can also start to get some measure on the parity violating couplings with SLHC data. And this, by the way, I've done this all for 1.5 TeV Z prime. You could do this for 3 TeV Z prime. It's not quite as good, but you can still get some restrictions on what the charges can be. Okay, so let me summarize this first part of the talk. So I've given you what I think is a nice parameterization for interpreting a Z prime signal. I've given you what I think is a very nice and simple analysis procedure just to take the experimental data, slice it up into 4 bins, and you can immediately invert without any model assumptions to find out what the underlying charges are and see what kind of Z prime you have. So the precision on the couplings reaches about 10%, if I just look at those ellipses and I kind of eyeball them, and it's limited primarily by Parton distribution functions, and particularly in a high luminosity stage at the LHC. Now, of course, with the LHC data, one is going to reduce Parton distribution function errors with measurements such as Z and W bosons on peak. And so the question is, one expects these Parton distribution function errors to be reduced by quite a bit, and there's a simple calculation one could do to determine how well it's going to work for this. I haven't done it yet. But you basically, you would just study the correlation of these PDF errors with those appearing from W and Z on peak. See how correlated they are and figure out what the statistics on W and Z production is going to be at the LHC. So I don't know how far down this 10 will go, but this 10 will go down with measurements of Parton distribution functions at the LHC. And there's a simple way to quantify it. Okay, now let me go on. I want to talk about something else now. So I showed you how to get 4 couplings, but there was a 5th coupling that popped up there. When I was introducing the Z primes, and you only get 4 or 5 due to this degeneracy in the quark lepton couplings that I talked about before. If I increase the quark couplings by 2, I decrease the leptons by 2, my cross section is unchanged. How do I break that? Well, I need something which treats the quarks and leptons differently. And at the LHC, I'm kind of stuck with having quarks in the initial state. So what I would think about having is have some kind of channel of quarks in the final state. This would break that degeneracy. So if I can measure some channel where I have quarks in the initial state, I have some additional quarks in the final state, I would break the degeneracy between the couplings. So the few modes you might think about doing this, well, DieJet's going to be tough just because of backgrounds. Here's a simulation at CMS about trying to see a sequential Z prime over QCD background, a DieJet channel. I think one could fairly well say that's hopeless. It's possible that you can do a TT-bar search, look for Z prime to TT-bar. This has been studied both by the experimental collaborations. This is in the context of a little Higgs model. It's been studied in the theory literature too. This is going to probably be possible, but it looks like the mass reach is going to be somewhat limited. It seems to me that about 1 TeV is about as good as you're going to get, although I should be careful with trying to quantify that. because I haven't looked at it too carefully. But okay, you can imagine looking for these kinds of modes. This one is probably impossible. This one's going to be tough. There are other experiments you can imagine trying to break this degeneracy with. ILC would do it. There's some interesting Jefferson Laboratory experiments on low-energy molar scattering, which actually could possibly do it. What I want to talk about is another somewhat indirect way, which will be interesting for another reason, and that's measurement of the width of the Z prime. So imagine I could measure the width of the Z prime, and I knew everything the Z prime decayed into. It turns out that then I could break this degeneracy. So here's just an expression for the width of the Z prime. I have various invisible decays. I have decays into leptons. I have decays into quarks. And I have decays into others, which I am now going to just X out for the time being. But imagine that I had only lepton and quark decays of the Z prime. And what I would find, if I could measure the width experimentally, if it was wide enough that I could measure it, well, I'd have some equation here, gamma equals gamma L plus gamma Q. I'd have measurements of these charges on peak, basically CQ, which if you look at it, is about equal to gamma L times gamma Q up to some factors. I could just take these two equations, and I can solve them, and I could break this degeneracy between quark-lepton couplings if I had a measurement of the width. So you just go through, you do the algebra, and you determine, for example, what the leptonic couplings are up to some discrete ambiguity. Now, there's an assumption here, and that's the fact that, well, if I forget about this gamma other for the time being, this gamma other would be decays like Z prime to Z Higgs, Z prime to WW, other things you would have to include. But this gamma invisible here, well, is it just neutrinos or is it something else? So if you knew it was just neutrinos for some reason, and you assumed SU2 left, which I think is fairly reasonable, you could do this. So this leads into the question, well, can you determine what the invisible decays of the Z prime are? And of course, this is interesting for many other reasons. There are, you know, it's a very distinct possibility, and there are several models in the literature where you actually have the Z prime acting as a messenger between the standard model and some hidden sector. That's shown schematically with the following diagram. Here's a standard model, here's some Z prime, here's some hidden sector that's over here. We heard one example of this from Matt a couple days ago, so-called hidden valley models. And if the states in this hidden valley, for example, or in, let's say, this is some mechanism of Suzy breaking and you have some hidden sector over here, if these states are stable, at least on the scales of collider time scales, you would see this as some invisible decay. You'd see this missing energy. There are reasons to consider that these might be absolutely stable. Possible dark matter candidates exist down there. So just as an example, how big can these hidden sector decays of the Z prime be? Well, in kind of, I guess, you call it a vanilla hidden valley model, these things can be up to 90% or so of the possible decays of the Z prime. So there's a whole other reason besides this ambiguity between quark and lepton couplings to try to see if the Z prime is decaying invisibly. So you ask yourself, well, okay, how could I imagine doing this study? I imagine I see a Z prime on peak. I see it in Drellian. I want to go now see, is it decaying into anything invisible? What kind of channels would I look at? So I kind of know where the kinematic region of the Z prime is. I know what the mass is. I kind of know the kinematics, so I know where to look. And you ask yourself, what are the channels? Well, monojet's probably going to be hard because of experimental systematics. We at least didn't study it. Other possible things which you could imagine doing are, for example, associated production of a Z prime and a Z, where the Z decays leptonically. This has been something that's been studied for invisible Higgs decays in the past. On the background to this, you can handle. They're all Di boson or possible Z plus jet, where you missed the jet. Also possible is a monophoton signature, where you have missing energy plus a photon. This one's a little bit tougher. You have backgrounds basically due to the fact that either electrons or jets are pretty good at faking photons. But you can go ahead, you can determine what all these things are. You can have reasonable estimates of the fake rates. You can ask yourself, can you see this? I'm going to skip all the details of fake rates and all that. But if you want to know, you can ask me later. So what you do is you go ahead, you do this. And your handles are, well, let's look at the two possible processes that we focused on, Z prime in association with the Z prime in association with a photon. Since the missing energy spectrum in this case knows about the mass of the Z prime, you have a kinematic handle where if I take the missing ET and I study a large missing ET tail, I'm going to have a preponderance of signal over background. The same thing for the gamma Z prime case. In the PT of the photon, it's going to know about the mass of the Z prime. I'm going to have a harder PT spectrum in this case. So you ask yourself, just if I have some background, if I put in all the backgrounds, for example, ZZ prime is shown right here, and the gamma Z prime case is shown right here. If I put in all these backgrounds and I ask myself, can I see what the signal is? Yes. I'm assuming that the Z prime mass is measured in Drellian. Although I'll come back to that in 1 second, as you can see. So if I assume the Z prime is measured on peak, I can go ahead and I can just look to see, can I see the signal over statistical fluctuation in the background? What's the Z prime cross section I need to do that? And it turns out if I increase these kinematic candles, the missing ET in this case, and the PT the photon in this case, for reasonable integrated luminosity, let's say 30 inverse femtobarns or so, I could see a Z prime with some invisible decays. And the way I quantify this is I, for example, take something like a U1 chi or sequential standard model, I imagine adding some vector-like hidden sector, I look at the decays, and I just see when I take a lower cut on, let's say, the missing ET or the PT of the photon and increase that, do I see an S over root B being greater than 5? Okay. I should also point out that if you have a Z prime that doesn't decay into leptons, if it's optophobic, you can imagine having some sliding window on these kinematic candles and looking to see if you can discover it this way. Okay. Yes. One thing I should point out, right now we just did a counting experiment based on a lower cut. This could be improved with some fit on the shape of the spectrum. We haven't done it yet. So I think these numbers will improve. Okay, there's the inconvenient issue of the normalization of the background. Do I have control over what the background is? Since I'm running out of time, I'll be very quick with this. But it turns out that there are some handles you can use on the background, particularly all these types of Dye boson production processes. You can imagine normalizing them and canceling a lot of systematic errors by using things like a Z or W on P. And this is an idea that's in the literature by Mikhail Dittmar and collaborators. For things like Z gamma, Z jet, you can imagine trying to normalize these to Dye photon or gamma plus jet samples. I'll kind of skip over this. But we're still studying how well we can do on the background. Okay, but let's assume the background is known, or we can control it to reasonably high precision, and we do observe something. How do we know it's not just decaying into neutrinos? So I want to talk about this real quick. So let's look at the structure of the cross-section for associated production of a Z prime. Let's look at this case right here. So I have a Z prime. It decays into either neutrinos or some hidden sectors. It then bremsstrahlungs off a Z or a gamma. This is the kind of thing that can occur for the monophoton signature. There's an additional thing that can occur for the Z prime Z signature where I can bremsstrahlung the Z off a final state neutrino. So these are the types of matrix element structures that appear if I'm calculating the signal. Now the important thing I want to note is the following. Let's look at this one right here. Let's take this diagram, let's compute it, and let's look at what the overall coupling structure is. So when I do that and I compute the overall coupling structure, well, I get some vector plus axial coupling squares of the Z prime. I get some charge of the photon coming from this vertex. I get some invisible branching fraction of the Z prime coming from this piece. And the important thing is that this can be, so imagine I have just neutrino decays, and if I assume SU2 left, this charge is something I can write completely in terms of that those on-peak things that I determined for you before. So these coupling C and E that we measured on-peak, they predict what the invisible width is. And so what you do is you go out, you measure the invisible width, you measure this cross-section, you extract an invisible width, and you see if the neutrino is saturated, basically. And you ask yourself, how well can you do this? Since I'm running out of the time, I won't talk too much about this, but it turns out that if you go ahead and you look at this, you put in some realistic errors are on what you how well you expect to know these charges from the on-peak measurement, you can exclude, let's say, with 100 inverse femtobarns or so, about Z-prime decays of about 25% of the total. So that's just the figure of merit, and we're still working a little bit on quantifying this. Okay, I'll conclude now. So there are many reasons to expect Z prime bosons to be at the TEV scale. Many different models have them appearing. It's hard to get around them, actually. And you can learn a lot of things from LHC data by studying these things carefully. So I told you about what I think is a nice way of parameterizing and extracting the couplings of the Z prime using the experimental data. You can potentially reach 10% or better precision on the couplings. I actually think this 10% number is going to go down because it's dominated by PDF errors, and you're going to measure those better at the LHC, and there's a way to study that. And there's also an interesting thing you can do is you can probe to see whether the Z prime is acting as a messenger to some light hidden sector by looking at these invisible Z prime decays from monophoton or Z plus missing energy signatures. Thanks.
So when you were saying that you were going to take SU2 to get a handle on the neutrino fraction of the width, Can you explain what you meant by that? Because I wasn't clear. Like, are you assuming there's no decoupling to right-handed electrons, or what is it that
No, what I'm assuming is the very mild assumption that the coupling of the neutrino to the Z prime is the same as the coupling of the left-hand electron appearing in the doublet, which I think is fine.
So it's not sense. So if I add arbitrary couplings to right-handed electrons and things
fine.
Like that, so I actually have, that's fine.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
So this is very interesting. What I'm taking away from your talk, I think, is that we don't have enough. I mean, there's a lot of positive things, but there's a negative thing as well, that we don't have enough information, in fact, to get a good control on the, let's call it gamma not invisible, which would include neutrinos plus other stuff that might be there, but the gamma hard to see, which includes jets and maybe tops, and then anything else which might not be invisible and therefore would not show up in this channel. So it's a gamma other, if you like.
So there's a few things to say about that. The first is, one question is, well, for example, do members of the third generation have the same coupling as members of the first two? You can try to get a handle on that, because assuming the Z prime is not too heavy, you will be able to do tau decays, you will be able to do top decays. Now the other thing, this gamma other, this is things, for example, mediated by ZZ prime mixing. Z Higgs decays, WW decays, you can go out and look for them.
Well, okay, but then there's also things like...
It might be only a bound you put on them and not a measurement. But
there's also things like Z goes to some hidden sector and the decays are not invisible, but they're just hard.
Exotics, yeah.
So...
That's a whole other analysis, which, as you've been tackling, is, you know, it's a tough one. It's very different.
What I think you're telling us is we're not going to get a lot of indirect information on that.
Well, no. Well, at least the analysis procedure that I'm giving you right now is really looking for things that are stable on the time scale of the detector. I have nothing to say about exotic decays. That's a whole other study.
I have a comment on this conclusion, on this 10% uncertainty that you want to reach in extracting the coupling constants. So when you talk about that kind of precision, you probably are in need for higher order QCD corrections beyond what you've incorporated. So you probably need to go to beat down on the PDF systematics by going to NNLO and improving that.
Well, okay, so let me try to understand. As far as the signal cross section goes, next to leading order is perfectly fine. Next leading order is, you know, is a percent or less.
This will be small, yeah.
So as far as the part time distribution functions, I think the question is how well are these things correlated with on peak Z and W cross sections? And that's a question that can be answered. And if the correlation is large, we're going to have very good measurements of those, and those are theoretically known quite well. So I think that this is very feasible, and I think even improvement of this is not unfeasible, because you're going to be using basically W and Z, and those are things that are well known.
Any other questions? Comments? Okay, let's thank the speaker again.